Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio for the listening pleasure of people who actually like new things, new angles and ways of looking at things, and like to do a lot more listening than they do talking, right? Especially when they're talking about something they know nothing about. All right, you know, like, people have been lied to their whole lives. Is it, oh, it's only death and taxes that you can be certain of? No, no. There's also people who are idiots who will talk about stuff they don't know nothing about. That's the other certainty, okay? It's unavoidable. And, like, especially if you're in any way attached to the internet, in any way, shape or form, these people will come out of the woodwork like termites devouring your staircase. Now, my very special guest is a prolific author, there was a pun in there somewhere, and his name is Ralph Ellis. Ralph, welcome to the program.
Nice to be with you, Vinny. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here so early in the Uber Kingdom morning. Now, I wanted to get a little bit of background on you, who you are, what it is you do, because I'm aware that you've done quite a number of books there of an ancient sort of origin. I was wondering what piqued your interest in it.
Yes. Well, I suppose I started with some of this sort of pyramid research, but that swiftly led me on to the religious aspect of it, because that had been a central part of my sort of research while I was doing it. And I'd already had an interest for a long, long time in the sort of biblical history. And this is from a sort of a Gnostic atheist point of view. So I'm looking at this very objectively, because none of it made very much sense to me. And everyone said, well, why don't you believe it? So I thought I'd better go out and actually find out why I believed it. And of course, the first thing you came across when studying the biblical text is this big connection with Egypt, and therefore with pyramid research and everything else that happens in Egypt. So that sort of started my interest. And of course, having started with the Old Testament and Egypt, it then led on to the New Testament. Who was Jesus? Why can't we find him in the historical record? And then lately, it's took me on to Arthurian history, because that is connected as well. You might not think it, but that was connected with the same story.
And by Arthurian history, you mean Arthur and his knights?
Yes, absolutely. Because my latest book, The Grail Cipher, says that that history was actually based upon New Testament history. It's another gospel. It's a heretical gospel of the Jesus story, and we can go through that later, because that's quite a lot of the things I write are a very different take on things to what anybody else has written, and that was certainly a very, very different take on Arthurian history, that it was based on biblical history. And very recently, just because I had a month or so spare, I wrote a science paper on climatology, on the formation of ice ages.
Yes,
so that was just as you do, you know, because I had some spare time, you know. So yeah, I wrote a proper peer review science paper on the modulation of ice ages. So yeah, so I've been fairly prolific. I've written 11 books now, 12 books, I forget now. And yes, they're all out there. They're all very interesting. They're all very novel. All of the ideas are very unique, very novel. And they are interesting because all the information
back up the track. So you write non-fiction books that are very novel.
Yeah, well, they are novel because they're novel in the new sense. They're very fresh ideas that nobody has had before. Although the first book was written back in 1997, so this is going back quite a long way. They're ideas that no one has had before. They've not been discussed before, and they all come from the original text. So this is not repeating what other people have said over the years. These all come from the original text, whether it's Egyptian text, whether it's actual Egyptian manuscripts, whether it's the Torah or the Talmud or Josephus's Jewish War and all of his books. They come from the original text, and it's just taking those original texts and looking at them very objectively, very rationally, and trying to find the real history within them. And the real history is there, because that's always been a very strange thing. You know, you read these books, well, some people do, lots of people claim to, but never do. But you read these biblical books, and it's as if the story they are telling happened on another planet, because none of the characters can be found in the historical record. I mean, you think about it, all of these people from, Adam and Eve and Moses and the original Old Testament, Joseph and everyone else in the Old Testament, all the way through even to King Solomon and King David. They can't be found in the historical record either. Through to the New Testament, you've got Saul, St. Paul, Jesus, all of the other characters from the New Testament. None of these people can be found in the historical record. Now, and for some that's reason, pretty strange.
I'm just thinking about this. When psychopaths have lied to me and told me a whole bunch of stories and whatnot, and then I go back and actually start looking at all these things that they've said and find out that there's absolutely nothing behind them and it's all just backed up, I realise that it's all just a story that a psychopath has concocted from a whole bunch of broad brush strings that have basically been used to marionette me and try to use me as some kind of human resource. That's not entirely dissimilar from what's going on here with religion, is it?
Well, precisely. You've got this story, and it's supposed to be an old historical story. And we know, elements of it are old and historical, because there are pieces of history within the Old Testament and the New Testament. But none of the main characters within this story that so many people believe in can be found in the historical record. And you've got to square that conundrum. How has that happened? How have they lost all of these characters from the historical record? And that was the basis of why I started looking at this. And lo and behold, as I started looking, being very objective on this, because you've got to be objective, you can't believe in it if you're going to look for these characters, they started to come out of the woodwork. And you could actually start to find them. I mean, one of the first ones I came across was the Israelites. I mean, who are the Israelites? Nobody knows. Well, it just so happens if you read Josephus Flavius, and he's the great Jewish historian from the first century, he actually says quite plainly that the Israelites were the Hyksos Egyptians from Egypt. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Hyksos, but the Hyksos were an Egyptian people. They ruled Egypt in the 16th, 17th century BC. And they were a fully Egyptianized people, but they were involved in a civil war, and they were kicked out of Egypt on a great exodus.
On a great hike.
Familiar story? Yeah, precisely. And if you look at all of the elements of the Exodus story, they're all there within the historical record. So you have these people, they were called shepherds, they wore curly side locks of hair and earrings, and they were circumcised, and they had a war with the Egyptians. There was darkness for 3 days and storms, and they were kicked out of Egypt. 500,000 of these people were kicked out of Egypt, and they traveled from Pi-Ramesses, and they went to Jerusalem. Familiar story? Mm. Yeah, that's the Exodus story. But that is actually the story of the Hyksos people, the Hyksos pharaohs of Egypt. And one of the Hyksos pharaohs, of course, was called Pharaoh Jacob. Hence, we have the Old Testament story. But as long as you realize that the Israelites were the Hyksos, they were Egyptians, so they weren't slaves, they were actually rulers of Egypt rather than being slaves. So you have to have an open mind, because you're now changing the story. They were no longer slaves in Egypt, they were co-rulers, because Egypt was split at the time between north and the south. And the Hyksos ruled the north, and the Egyptians, as they called them, ruled the south down in Thebes. And they had this civil war, and they were kicked out of Egypt. So there we have the beginnings now of the Old Testament story. Who these people?
Who sparked the civil war?
Well, there were differences. There were theological differences between the Hyksos and the Egyptians. So, like always within politics and religion, there were differences and disagreements, and this precipitated a civil war. And it's actually quite an interesting question, that, because what I think actually precipitated this war was the changing of the heavens. And so as we discuss all of this, all of it comes back to the zodiac and astrology. Not the standard daily zodiac. This is the millennial zodiac, the processional zodiac. And it just so happens that at this time, this is about 1750 BC or something like that, Taurus gave way to Aries in the night sky. So Aries then became the dominant constellation. And that's why they were called shepherd kings, because Aries is obviously the constellation of the lamb. So these people who called themselves shepherds had changed their religion from the worship of bulls, which was the old Egyptian traditional religion, to the worship of sheep. And there's a great discussion in the Old Testament between Joseph and Pharaoh about this change between bulls and sheep. And if you read the biblical version, it makes no sense whatsoever, because they're trying to describe it in terms of agriculture. And of course, it had nothing to do with agriculture whatsoever. It was a change in the heavens above between Taurus and Aries. And if you read it in that fashion, suddenly it starts to make sense. And so you can see here my interest being piqued, because here we had a story that made absolutely no sense from the Old Testament whatsoever, saying that the Egyptians hated shepherds, which is not true whatsoever, of course. But suddenly now, if you interpret it in terms of astrology, suddenly, yes, they hated the shepherd kings, yes, because they were the Hyksos, they were the people they were having the civil war with. So now you can start to see real history within the Old Testament.
When I interviewed Gilad Adzmon, he says that the history of the Jewish people, it's just basically a chain after events of one Holocaust that they've caused on themselves after another, that they then play the victim on, and then become oppressive, and then cause another Holocaust on themselves again, and so on and so forth, right? That's the kind of historical play here that we see happening, isn't it?
Well, you could say that. Because they have their very, very strong beliefs, in this case, in the changing of the heavens between Taurus and Aries, they did spark a revolution within Egypt. And then later on, they turned that around, because that story didn't resonate very well with the people. It's much easier to sell a sob story of being oppressed. So instead of them being the dominant nation within Egypt, they said, oh, you know, we were oppressed by those terrible Egyptians, and they threw us out of Egypt because, you know, we were slaves and all the rest of it. So, yes, they turned the story around so as not to blame themselves.
Let me guess. The exact same thing happened when they got themselves kicked out of Israel by the Romans. They're like, no, we're not going to like bow down here, mate. We're going to do our own thing or whatever. We're not going to.
Well, yes, and that's the big story of the New Testament. And this is where I came into the New Testament story, because we have this same problem with the New Testament, that none of these characters can be found in the historical record. I mean, you think about it. You've got all these, you know, Saul, who wrote the New Testament virtually, Jesus and James and all of the disciples and all of these other characters. None of them can be found in the historical record. Why is that? Well, because we have this slight cover-up again, the same as we've seen in the Old Testament, where the characters have had their character changed, But also in this, in both cases, yes, they've had the date changed as well, so you cannot find them. So if you're looking for the Exodus, you can't find it in the 13th century BC because it didn't happen then. It actually happened in the 15th century BC. And it's only when you look in the right era that you can actually find it. Same with the New Testament. All of the New Testament is supposed to be about AD 30 because that's what you've been told. But it's not. It's about AD 70. It's about the Jewish revolt, exactly what you were just talking about, the Jewish revolt from Rome. That was the story of the New Testament. That's why Jesus was imprisoned alongside revolutionaries who had committed murder in the revolution, as it says in the Gospel of Matthew. What revolution was this in the AD 30s? There was no revolution in the AD 30s. The revolution of the New Testament is the Jewish revolt, which happened in AD 70. So now we start looking in the right era for this story. And suddenly all the characters start dropping out of the woodwork. Suddenly we can find all of the disciples, all of, you know, Jesus and Saul. We know who they are because we're looking in the right era. So yes, what they've done is they've covered up this story because this became a Roman story, because it was the Romans who wrote it. And it was written by their favorite Jewish poodle, who was Josephus Flavius. And it was a story about the Jewish revolt. But the Romans didn't want anyone knowing about the Jewish revolt because they wanted peace on the eastern borders. They didn't want another revolution. So what they created was a sort of icing sugar-coated version of the Jewish revolt.
It's PR.
Yeah, so it was pure propaganda. So suddenly these people were Rome-friendly. Render unto Caesar what belongs to Caesar. So they were changing these revolutionaries into a Rome-friendly, peaceful organization instead of the revolutionary organization that they really were. And so that was a subject of my later books. That started, I call that the King Jesus trilogy, although now it's a trilogy in five parts. It's sort of expanded slightly. So that started with Cleopatra to Christ, and then it went on to King Jesus, which is a big fat 600-page book. And then it went on to Jesus, the King of Edessa, because I actually identified him in the historical record. So he's a real character. I found him in the historical record, exactly the same as he is in the New Testament story. With a few twists to the story, because he's no longer a pauper. Again, we have this pauper story, you know, the slave story. But he wasn't. He was a king. He was a real king, a powerful king, a very rich king. Mary Magdalene, as it says in the Talmud, because the Talmud also mentions them. This is, you get a lot of these historians saying, oh, it was all mythical. It was all made up. There is no evidence for the New Testament story. Therefore, these are all fictional characters. And we've seen quite a few books come out recently about the fictional Jesus. But the Talmud mentions Jesus on a number of occasions. And not very favorably either, because the Jews don't like him.
Well, obviously.
Why would... Well, because he destroyed Jerusalem, because he started the Jewish revolt. And the end of the Jewish revolt was the destruction of Jerusalem and the scattering of the Jews all over the Roman Empire. So, of course, they hated him because he wasn't an Orthodox Jew. He was a Nazarene. He was a splinter group of Judaism, and he started the Jewish revolt. And so, yeah, after this had all happened and the Talmud was written, he was not a very popular character. And so it has wonderful sections within Talmud where it says that Jesus should be boiled in shit and semen and all this sort of stuff. But you've got to ask yourself, why would the Talmud concern itself with talking about a fictional character? Of course, it wouldn't. There would be no point writing a book about, you know, which is a central part of Judaism, about a fictional character who never existed. They're writing about him because he did exist. And strangely enough, when they mention him, they tend to say that he was a king. And that backs up, of course, what I've been saying and what a lot of other books saying. You know, if you read things like The Golden Legend and so on, it says that Mary Magdalene was a queen, a princess. And the Talmud says the same. The Talmud says that Mary Magdalene was the richest woman in Judea. She was Mary Bothus. She had a 1 million sesterce dowry when she got married. So 1 million gold coins was her dowry. She was a millionaire in that era. And I've calculated that out in terms of work value into the modern era. And it's a dowry that works out at about $5 billion or something. It was a huge dowry. So suddenly we have this alternate idea, alternate perception of what this story is about. It was a real story about a real revolution, yet another revolution. But this time it was a revolution against Rome. So we're not even talking about a revolution against the Jews in Jerusalem. We're talking about a revolution against Rome. Because now we are in the AD 60s, late AD 60s, and the throne of Rome was empty because Nero committed suicide in AD 68, and the throne of Rome was empty, and there was a battle going on for the next emperor of Rome, and four contenders came and went, but there was another contender, a contender who's never mentioned. This is called the Year of Four Emperors in Roman history, because four emperors came and went. But there was a fifth that nobody mentions. And the fifth emperor who tried to become emperor of Rome was the biblical Jesus. And that's why they started the revolution in the East, because it wasn't a revolution to take Jerusalem from the Orthodox Jews. It was a revolution to take over the whole of Rome, and he wanted to become the next emperor. But the only person who stood between him and the emperorship was Commander Vespasian. And so we have the Jewish revolt, which is this big revolt between King Jesus, who was the king who started the Jewish revolt, and Commander Vespasian. But it was Commander Vespasian, the Roman army with his six legions, who won this war. And King Jesus, he lost this war. And so who became the next emperor? Well, it was Vespasian became the next emperor. So this great battle, this great Jewish revolt in the East, was a battle between two contenders for the throne of Rome. And the winner was actually Vespasian, and he became the next emperor. So, yes, who was the other contender? Well, this is, again, it's never really mentioned because there's been a great cover-up as to what actually happened during the Jewish revolt. Because remember, the Jewish revolt was written, the history of it, was written by Josephus Flavius, who was the favorite Jewish yes-man of Vespasian, Emperor Vespasian. And his name was Josephus Flavius, who wrote the whole history of Judea.
Is there an attempt not only to cover up the truth of what actually happened, but to conceal it and keep it for themselves and teach it to their own secret society so that their own secret societies know the truth and can wield its power?
Not from the Roman perspective. Yes, from the Edessan perspective, perhaps, afterwards. Because, of course, this was not secret when it was happening, because this was an open revolt against Rome. After all of this had blown over and they had lost the revolution, of course, the Romans wanted to play it down. They didn't want this idea that anyone could start a revolt against the powerful Roman Empire. So they had to play it down. And they played it down by getting their favorite yes-man and historian, who was Josephus Flavius, to write all of these books. And what he did is he wrote The Jewish War, which was his slightly glossed over version of the Jewish revolt, a very Rome-friendly one, of course. The Romans are always portrayed as in a favorable light. And then he wrote as well the Gospels. So a lot of the Gospels were written by Saul, St. Paul. But if you look at the history of St. Paul, and this is another of these characters who's gone missing from the historical record, nobody knows who this guy is, but if you look at the history of St. Paul, it is blatantly obvious that he is Josephus Flavius. So suddenly we found the main author of the New Testament. We found him in the historical record. He is Josephus Flavius. And now it begins to make sense because he's the guy who wrote most of the gospel stories. So suddenly we have the same character, Josephus Flavius, writing the Jewish revolt and the spiritual version of the Jewish revolt, because it's the same story. If you read the New Testament, it's virtually the same as the Jewish War written by Joseph Flavius. There's always this strange conundrum within the literary world that everybody knows that Gospels like Acts of the Apostles and Luke share a great similarity with the works of Joseph Flavius. And nobody is quite sure why this is. Why was Luke and Acts borrowing elements from Josephus's Jewish War? It didn't really make sense. But if they were the same author, of course, now it makes perfect sense. So now you have this Rome-friendly author writing the history of Judea, but now also the spiritual history as well of Judea, which is the Gospels and the Acts of the Apostles. Acts of the Apostles and all of the epistles as well, were all written by the same person or edited by the same person. And so now you find that the gospel story is another version of the Jewish War. It just has a sort of spiritual gloss on it and yet even more icing sugar applied. But it's the same story, and it's a story about a revolution against Rome, as we've said. But the central characters have been covered up. So if you read Jewish War, all it mentions is they were the kings of Adiabene, which is a fictitious place. Nobody knows where Adiabene is. It's supposed to be somewhere off in Iraq. It's supposed to be Arbela, which is near Mosul over in Iraq. But this is a fictitious place because there is no evidence for a monarchy in that part of Iraq. And there's no evidence for these particular monarchs, even though, again, they're mentioned in the Talmud. So the Talmud mentions them as well, Queen Helena and Monobazus, the King Monobazus. But they're all fictitious because we cannot find them in historical records. We have this same conundrum again where everyone is missing from the historical record. But it was quite obvious when I started reading this that Monobazus is not a name. Monobazus is a very poor Greek rendering of the only king, which was the name given to Jesus, of course, in the Gospels. He was called the only king. Monobazus means only king. So we don't have the name of this guy. Who is this guy? Who is this Monobazus who started the Jewish revolt against Rome? This is the king and the queen who started the Jewish revolt. Who are they? We don't know. And nobody seems to concentrate on them. If you read a history of the Jewish revolt, it never really says who created the revolt. It just mentions the Jewish revolt. It doesn't have the name of the leaders and why they were doing this. Why? Well, because it's very contentious. And it wasn't until I was out in Syria and various places over in there that I started to find the alternate version of this. And courtesy of various divisions within the Christian world, the Eastern Church became dislocated from the Western Church. So we had the main one was the Council of Chalcedon, which separated off the Syriac Church from the Western Church, from the Greek Orthodox and from the Roman Church. And then we had the invasion by the Muslims who came from modern Saudi Arabia, and took over the whole of the Christian East. Because remember, all of the Christian East was Christian and Jewish. So all of Iraq was Christian and Jewish. All of Syria was Christian. All of Jordan, Egypt, North Africa, all of Turkey, all was Christian empire until the coming of Islam. And that cut off the entire Syriac church from what was going on in the West. So the Western Roman Catholic Church had no control whatsoever over the texts that were being written or being preserved over in the East. And it wasn't until, and this is why Arthurian legend comes into this, it wasn't until the 12th century and the Crusades that some of these texts started coming back out of the East. And one of those, well, several of those texts gave a Syriac history of the Jewish war. So now we have an alternate version at last. So before we were dependent on Josephus Flavius, but now we had a Syriac version that had been totally divorced from the Roman version for hundreds of years. And that Syriac version and the Armenian version of the Jewish war identified the king who created this revolt, not as Monobazus of a fictitious place called Adiabeni, but as King I always get his name wrong because it's spelt differently in different texts. The Romans call him Agabus, but his real name was Abgarus, King Abgarus of Edessa. And he was the king who started the Jewish revolt against Rome in AD 70, the revolt that became the basis of the New Testament. So now we have a name. His father was called King Agbarus. The son in AD 70 was called King Isis Manu of Edessa, which is in northern Syria. And now we begin to see the New Testament story coming out because they have the same name. So in the Bible, he's called King Jesus Manuel. And in real history, he is called King Isis Manu, King Manu the Fifth of Edessa. Now we have the Jesus character. We know who he is. He is King Isis Manu of Edessa. And he ruled Edessa, which is actually in Turkey nowadays. It's modern Sanlurfa, which is in southeastern Turkey. But it used to be part of the Syriac Empire. It's just north of Aleppo where they're fighting at present. And he controlled all of that region. So he would have controlled Aleppo and also Antioch, which is, you know, on the Mediterranean coast, all the way through to Diyarbakir, which was Amida, which is on the Tigris. And all the way down to Palmyra, where ISIS has just destroyed all of Palmyra. Palmyra was his second city. So his primary capital city was Edessa. His second city was Palmyra, the one that ISIS has just gone and destroyed.
When the United States invaded Iraq, the, what was it? I think its main target in Baghdad was the museum. And a lot of things actually got destroyed, as I believe. And now ISIS seems to be doing the precise same thing, destroying all these old relics, sites and things of this nature, demolishing them. You know, we can't afford food and water, but we can afford incredibly massive construction vehicles and world-class explosives that can blow the parts out of ancient relics for no reason at all other than propaganda for ourselves, which...
Well, this has been a central part of Islam for thousands, well, nearly thousands of years, hundreds of years. It says in the Quran, look upon the ruins of the past, because this demonstrates that God did not favor these people. He will only favor you. So within Islam, there is a central command to create ruins, which is what they always do, which is why you have this needless destruction where they're just destroying things like tombs. They destroyed all the tombs in Palmyra, these big tower tombs, wonderful tower tombs. What did that have to do with idolatry or anything of that nature or iconoclasm? Had nothing to do with the nature of God, the image of God, creating God. It was a tomb, for goodness sake, and they destroyed all of the tombs in Palmyra. It's because they have this command within the Quran to create ruins, because ruins show that these people were not favored by God.
Eliminating
the
competition.
It's very destructive. Yeah, it's a very destructive religion, and that's what they do. All of the history of Palmyra, unfortunately, has been rather destroyed. I don't know how much of the museum has been destroyed, because there was a rumor that the museum creator had actually taken all of the relics away and hidden them somewhere. So I do hope he has. But yeah, they did the same to the Baghdad Museum as well. They destroyed all of the relics there. Mm. And it was fairly disorganized anyway. When the Americans got there later, they found three storage units, which big storage units, which were completely untouched. And when they went in there, they kept saying, well, what's this? And they go, we don't know, actually. Where did it come from? What era? Well, we don't know. And literally, they've got these three storage units full of artifacts that no one had ever bothered to document. And it was just crazy. So you got this museum. And of course, once you lose the context of where something was actually discovered, you lose what it actually is, because you've got no idea anymore. Mm. And nobody had bothered to document any of these relics. It's absolutely crazy. But yes, there was wanton destruction everywhere, which is just as well that a lot of these relics are actually in the Louvre and in the British Museum and various other places. Otherwise, they'd have destroyed everything.
That reminds
because
me of a,
the history.
A joke by Steve Hughes. There was a lot of looting in England at one point, and he was laughing at the newscasters because they seemed really shocked by the looting. He said, "Have you ever been to the British Museum? Where do you think they got those pyramids from? Norwich."
Yes, you could say that, but this was looting. Not for the interest in history, which was, if you want to call it something like looting, which was what the Louvre and the British Museum were doing. They were preserving relics so we could preserve the history. The people who were looting in Baghdad were not doing that. This is just pure greed. The trouble is with Islam is nothing existed prior to Muhammad. So prior to the 7th century, there was nothing. Nothing ever existed prior to that. So all of history is complete nonsense to them. It's just a pagan past to be destroyed and forgotten. They have no appreciation of past history and past peoples, past civilization. And so it is to be destroyed, to be looted, to be sold. And that is the complete antithesis of the purpose of the Louvre and the British Museum, who were there to preserve history, not to destroy it. And in fact, to pay for it, not to use it for financial gain. You know, the British Museum bought artifacts with hard cash. Mm. So yes, it is the complete opposite in many respects.
Now, getting back into the history here, because we were talking about what was it, King Jesus? You reckon
Jesus,
was Jesus? And he led this revolution in Rome, and that led to the Jews being ousted out of Judea and scattered throughout Europe, essentially, right?
Yes.
And ever since then, it seems that there's been a concerted effort on the part of Talmudic followers to bring about that revolution over the empire again. Do you think that's supported by a historical claim?
Not especially, no, because you've got to remember the Jews were bystanders in all of this. They didn't cause the Jewish revolt. The Jewish revolt was caused by the Nazarene, and they were not Orthodox Jews. This goes back to the history of Judaism and what is Judaism. If you go to modern Israel or even North London, the guys with the curly sidelocks and the strange sort of 17th century outfits are not proper Jews. Judaism was Egyptian. They were the Hyksos Egyptians from Egypt, and their religion was substantially Egyptian. Egyptian in terms of the zodiac and astrology mainly. And that religion has morphed into what we know today as Judaism, because there was this constant battle between the imagery of the zodiac, between the followers of Taurus, the bull, the Apis bull of Egypt, and the new followers of Aries, the shepherd kings. And the same happened in the New Testament era, where Jesus was born as a lamb of God. He was born under Aries. But in AD 10, Aries changed into Pisces within procession, within processional astrology. And so Jesus became a fisher of men. He became a king of Pisces. He became one of the Arthurian fisher kings. So again, we have this astrological change within the heavens being recorded within the religion of the time. But this change in the constellations caused a civil war. It caused the first one. It caused the Great Hyksos Civil War. And what somebody at some point decided to do was, if you get rid of all of this iconography of bulls and sheep, you should get rid of that contention and prevent another civil war. And so what somebody did, and that somebody was Pharaoh Akhenaten from Egypt, what he did was to get rid of the god figures. And so he said, right, there's only one God who's the God of all gods, and he has no particular image. And so he created monotheism. And that was the basis of modern Judaism. So modern Judaism was founded by Pharaoh Akhenaten and his brother called Moses. So the brother of Akhenaten was Moses. And, of course, these are the two brothers, the famous brothers of the Old Testament. Aaron and Moses, the biblical Moses, was Akhenaten and his brother called Moses. And they created monotheism. That's where monotheism came from. And that's why, if you look at the Talmud, the God of Moses was called, yes, he was called Yahweh, we all know that, but his other name was Aten. He was the Aten of Akhenaten. This was their god. So you have now this monotheism taking over from the original astrological religion of the Hyksos. So when we come to modern Judaism, we have this great split between Judaism. We have people now following this monotheism with an iconoclastic god who has no image. You're not allowed to draw any images of this god, pretty much like Akhenaten said. And then you have the followers of the original religion, which was obviously Egyptian and astrological. And these alternate Jews, as it were, because they're now so separate it's very difficult to call them Jews, were the Nazarene, the Ebionites, the Church of Jesus and James. They were the alternate Jewish religion. And it clearly states in the New Testament, of course, that St. Paul, Saul, was a Nazarene. And it also states that Jesus was a Nazarene as well. And within the Talmud, the Talmud also states that Queen Helena, who was the mother of Jesus when we go back to Edessa, she was also a Nazarene. She became a Nazarene Jew. And so did all the people of Palmyra as well. They were Nazarene. And this was the alternate, what they called in what Josephus calls the fourth sect of Judaism. So Judaism was very divided. We have the the Sadducees, we have the Pharisees, we have the Essene down on the Dead Sea, the spiritual sect of the Essene, and we also have the Nazarene, the fourth sect of Judaism. And it was the fourth sect, according to Josephus, that started the Jewish revolt. And so these were the more radical believers in the old religion of Egypt, rather than the modern Judaism as it even was then.
The King David hotel bombers of their day kind of thing.
Yeah, a revolutionary sect. Yeah, very much so. I suppose, like, as you might say, those bombers, they were forging their own revolution against Orthodox Judaism, but using that as a springboard to gain control over Rome, because, as I said before, the throne of Rome was empty, and it was open to whoever had enough backing and enough forces to actually take the throne of Rome, because that's how Rome worked. I mean, there were no elections. It was just who could gather enough support, who had enough money to gather support, who could buy enough support, who could gather a large enough army together to gain the throne from the previous emperor. That's how Rome quite often worked. That's how Vespasian became the next emperor. He didn't just walk into Rome. He had to defeat another two contenders for the throne of Rome before he could become the next emperor. And as I said before, Jesus, King Jesus, was the other contender. And yes, he did have a big army. He had one of the biggest armies in that region. When they came out of Iraq, because they were originally from Iraq, that's another story altogether. We haven't mentioned that, have we? How did they get to Edessa? How did he become the king of Edessa? Because he was an Egyptian. Out of Egypt I have called my son. Jesus was educated in Egypt. That's what it says in the New Testament. His mother fled to Egypt to protect him from Herod. Why was Herod so afraid of carpenters? Well, he wasn't, but he was afraid of princes, especially princes who were more well-connected than he was, which is why he went to Egypt. He went to Egypt for his education. He went to Alexandria. And we know that because of the turning water into wine. Turning water into wine was a favorite trick of Hero of Alexandria. Hero of Alexandria was the Leonardo da Vinci of the first century. This was the guy who created all sorts of mechanical devices. He created singing birds, automatic doors, vending machines, fire engines. He made everything. But one of his favorite tricks was turning water into wine, for which he made trick jugs. And they're very technical. There are four or five different versions he made. But the cleverest, I think, is based on water surface tension and siphonic action. And you have a little hole in the top of the jug that you put your finger over. And depending on whether you've covered the hole or released the hole, depends on whether you pour out water or wine. So you can pour out water for one person and wine for the next person. And of course, they're all amazed because you've just turned water into wine. Now, this was a favorite trick of the first century. And he came from Alexandria. And it's included in the New Testament as a miracle. But of course, it's not a miracle. We know it's not a miracle. And so we know that this Jesus character had links back to Alexandria and to Hero of Alexandria, who created all of these tricks for the aristocracy of this era. So we know that Jesus was connected with Alexandria, and he was an aristocrat. He was a prince. And he came out of Egypt. So how did these people end up in Edessa? It's a long story. It's a very interesting story. But I'll try and break it down into a few minutes worth.
About 90 seconds left in the segment, roughly.
Oh, well, maybe we should do it after the segment then, because it's longer than 90 seconds.
All right. Well, we've got to give it its due, so to speak. Now,
yes.
I also wanted to...
I've led you off on such a story, you don't know where you are now. Where are we? Yes.
That's called history. Now,
yeah.
we wanted to remind listeners that American Freedom Radio is a listener-supported network, so please go to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and start donating regularly to help them pay their bills, as well as I am a listener-supported independent media entity. I don't know what I am. Quite frankly, that's the point of life, isn't it? Figure out who the hell you are. But in the meantime, give me money. Now, if you go to the VinnyEastwoodShow.com, that's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood, like, go ahead, make my news. You can make a donation either through the PayPal, or if you happen to be a New Zealand listener, if you're unfortunate enough to be confined to this Agenda 21 poisoned lake fiesta that we call a country, you can use the government/private/corporate interest-owned bank known as Kiwi Bank to give me some cash that way. If we do so on a regular basis, it means I don't have to stress about where the food's coming from, if the bills are getting paid. That allows me to just do the work without worrying about my survival, which is really like the ideal, you know? Like, imagine that, if you didn't have to quite worry about your survival, so you could actually do important things with your time! Now, unfortunately, most people have slave jobs. I know you do. And I so much very appreciate you giving your servitude to the system and then giving me, like, a little bit of that slice of the pie. It's kind of like the Church of Vinnie Eastwood. Yes, donate today and I will absolve you of your corporate slavery sins. And I will make sure to pay as little taxes as possible on that donation money, bro. But seriously, though, I do understand that you've got some books as well here, Ralph. So if you go and Google Ralph Ellis, ladies and gentlemen, it comes up with his website and a number of the books that he has on sale. You are listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. If you've enjoyed this last hour, try and get yourself a little bit of that Ralph Ellis magic on your library bookcase. We'll be right back after the break. The Vinnie Eastwood Show.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It is the Vinnie Eastwood Show for your listening pleasure. Now, my very special guest, Ralph Ellis, was going to tell us about how the aforementioned Eases manages to get his way from Egypt all the way up there to Odessa, where he eventually went to start and foment a revolution to try and grab the seat of power from the Romans, as was the custom in those days. Ralph, welcome back.
Yeah, good to be back with you. Yes. Yeah, been an interesting story so far, hasn't it?
Well, you know, that's what happens when you tell real stories as opposed to fabled nonsense with a whole lot of the details missing inextricably for some reason.
Yes. Yeah, they have changed the story quite a bit. Well, no, actually, they've not. This is an interesting thing about my research, actually. The story remains completely the same. The context is quite different, because quite often these people end up as being very powerful, very influential monarchs, regional monarchs, world monarchs. It's a tale of trying to climb this slippery pole, and sometimes they climb up and sometimes they fall down. But it's a very interesting international story about a very powerful monarchy that came from Egypt. So these were all Egyptians. So, yes, how did Isis Manu end up in Odessa? Well, that's an interesting story in itself, because who was this guy? As I said, they came from Egypt. They were Hyksos Egyptians. All of the Israelites were Egyptians, if they traced their history back properly. Now, this started with Julius Caesar. So I trace this history back to a very specific event, which is when Julius Caesar was assassinated in Rome in 43 BC, I think it was. And so his wife, well, he had a wife, but his second wife at the time was Queen Cleopatra of Egypt. And Cicero specifically says that Cleopatra was pregnant when she left Rome. So as soon as Julius Caesar was murdered, she departed for Egypt. And Cicero says that she was pregnant.
They didn't call him Caesar for nothing.
Yeah, well, he was very worried about this because he didn't want another Caesar taking over the Roman Empire, especially one from Egypt. He didn't want an Egyptian prince taking over Rome. But then after a few months, he was happy and the crisis had passed. Why? Well, because if the child was a daughter instead of a son, then they were not entitled to become the next Caesar, the next emperor. And so what I think happened, and there are various strands of evidence, is that Cleopatra had another daughter at that time. And we hear nothing about this daughter for many years, for about 20 years, until Octavian comes to the throne. And Octavian is trying to sort out his borders, the borders of Rome. And to his old friend, Juba II, from Mauritania, which is North Africa, he gives him one of the daughters of Queen Cleopatra, who's called Cleopatra Selene. And she becomes the queen of Mauritania. Now, he then goes to his eastern borders, to Persia, or Parthia, as it was known at the time. And he has to do something to placate the king, who's Phraates IV. And so he gives Phraates IV a courtesan, a prostitute. Now, that doesn't strike me as being very likely, especially as Phraates IV was so pleased with this prostitute that he makes her the queen of all Persia. And she is called Queen Theomusa Aurania. You might not have heard of her, but she is another forgotten queen from this history. And it's quite clear from the context and from everything else that happens that this strange courtesan that was given by Octavian to the king of Persia was in fact the lost daughter of Queen Cleopatra. That's why he gave one daughter to Juba II and he gave the other daughter, the elder daughter, to Phraates IV as a diplomatic gift. And she became the queen of Persia. More than that, she killed her husband and became the total queen of Persia. And she was called Queen Theomusa Aurania, or in Western history, she's called Thermusa. And the Persians were not very impressed with Queen Theomusa Aurania because she was a little bit too brazen. She put her image, the image of a woman, on the coinage and things of this nature. And anyway, she got thrown out of Persia. And she was thrown out along with 600 cavalry from Persia and 200 courtiers and went westwards to Syria. So where did she end up? Well, she ended up in Edessa. This is where the monarchy of Edessa came from. And at first, when I thought about this, it seemed obvious for a start that there was a corollary here with the New Testament story. Because what is the New Testament story based upon? It's based upon a king, and Jesus is called a king on 32 occasions within the New Testament. A king who was born not in a palace, but in a state of poverty, somewhere in Syria or Judea. And who was feared by the local monarch, who was Herod, of course, and who was visited by the Persian Magi. Now, why would the Persian Magi, the priest of Persia, be interested in a Jew being born in Judea? Doesn't make sense.
He carried the bloodline of a former king of Persia.
Precisely. Now
just taking a stab in the dark.
Stab in the dark, yeah, as you do. Now there's a reason for the Persian Magi to come to his birth because, yes, he was a prince of Persia.
I got a joke for you about that, actually. What the three wise men say when they said when a star told them that the Son of God had been born? They went, "Bro, are you serious?"
Well, yeah, well, I suppose they were serious, yeah. Were they serious? Oh, yes, I see what you mean. Yes, are you serious? Oh, okay, yeah, I get it.
My bad.
it's the accent. I didn't get the serious bit. Yeah, so this is why the Persian Magi came to see Jesus when he was being born, because he was a potential prince of Persia. And so they wanted to see him and assess him, and etc., and bring him gifts. But this was now the monarchy of Edessa. This is how the monarchy of Edessa suddenly came about in the first century, beginning of the first century, because these people came out of Persia. And she not only, I thought they were in a state of poverty to start with when I first started this research, but it became clear later that they came out of Persia, not just with half the army and many of the courtiers, but with half the Persian treasury as well. So they were not short of a bob or two, as we say over here. They were filthy rich, but they still didn't have anywhere to live because, of course, they just moved to a small town called Edessa, and they were trying to turn Edessa into a city-state, which they did, and it became very, very powerful. Although it's not mentioned, and this is another strange thing, this is where the cover-up starts coming in, the very big millennial cover-up of these actions. Because if you read Josephus Flavius was the historian who wrote the whole history of this region and the whole history of the Jewish people. He wrote his own Torah, which is called Antiquities of the Jews. So he wrote the whole history of this region, except that he never mentions Edessa once, and he never mentions the kings of Edessa once. Why is that? When they were very, very powerful and very influential in this region. In fact, so influential, they're mentioned in Acts of the Apostles as Agabus, who's in Acts of the Apostles, who is King Agbarus. And yet he never mentions them once. Why? Because there has been a millennial, not just a cover-up, but deletion of this monarchy from the historical record. We would not know anything about King Agbarus, or Abgarus, as he was originally known, if it wasn't for the Syriac historians. We only know about this royal family, A, because a lot of his coins started turning up in Palmyra and Europa, which is over on the Euphrates. Duras Europa, they call it. But we would know nothing about these kings if it wasn't for the Syriac and the Armenian historians who preserved their history, because Josephus never mentions them once.
This doesn't have anything to do with the Armenians getting exterminated by the Turks around that particular region.
Oh, absolutely. Part of the same history, although that's a much later history, of course, because that was 20th century. 3 million Armenians were murdered and exiled by the Turks. And at the same time, which is not mentioned, 500,000 Greeks were also murdered and exiled by the Turks, because Izmir used to be a Greek city up until 1922, until they burnt it down and killed and exiled all of the Greeks.
Well, as they say, Izmir, and now it isn't there.
It's certainly not there anymore. Well, it used to be called Smyrna, was its original name, before they exiled all the Greeks. But that's another story, because that's 2,000 years on.
But isn't it interesting, though, how so many things that are about 2,000 years on are really still affecting us today? And I think this is actually congruent with the entirety of history. All of history is affecting us today in some small way. And I think that's why it's been largely forgotten about, because if people remembered all the real history, a lot of the problems that exist today, conflicts between people, etc., if the truth was simply there for all of us and we all knew it, how much conflict would there really be? Because I found so many conflicts are based upon two people's misunderstanding of the same thing, or one person lying and the other person not understanding why they're saying what they're saying.
That is very true, because, yes, these conflicts do occur because of these millennial cover-ups and because various people have jumped onto various bandwagons who have a different idea of the same history and therefore have caused a conflict between themselves. And the classic one is the new Christian bandwagon versus the old, how should we call it, Gnostic bandwagon, which, because Jesus was... here's another fundamental for you. Christianity has nothing to do with Jesus. And I think some of your listeners will be more adept at that one.
It's sun worship.
Yeah, because Christianity was created by Saul. It was the church of Saul.
And what does the word Saul mean?
Saul, well, he borrowed that from the original king of Israel, who was called Saul, but his real name was Saint Paul, but he called himself Saul to his friends. Although I think that might be the other way around, because Saint Paul just means junior, and he was called the junior because he was the younger brother of Barnabas.
Oh, I thought it just meant so Saul meant son. Or son in the sky, or son below you, kind of your baby son.
Well, he traces his history back to Saul and the Benjamites. So I think he just borrowed the name Saul because it was the first king. He was the first king of Israel, as it were, and he saw himself as the king of Israel. He never made it, of course, because no one accepted him. But he thought he was another Saul, and so he called himself Saul.
So he became a bit of a Saul loser.
Yeah, he was. Because the whole of Christianity was written and created by Saul. The Church of Jesus was a completely different church. And these two churches became enemies, as it says in Acts of the Apostles. And so Saul hates the Church of Jesus so much, he calls them the circumcised. Because that's the difference between them. Because the Church of Saul was not circumcised, and they didn't have beards. Whereas the Church of Jesus and James was circumcised, did have beards, and did adhere to Mosaic law, whereas Saul did not. So we have these two churches, and they became enemies of each other. And it was the Church of Saul who won this battle and became Christianity. So anyone following Christianity is following the religion of Jesus' enemy. And they don't understand that. This is the whole basis of the Christian conundrum.
One might get that impression that the Christian faith, and the Catholic faith in particular, is on Satan's side if you have a look at what they named their observatory, Lucifer. Oh, yeah. I'm wondering about that.
But even Lucifer is another misunderstanding completely. Lucifer is just a falling star. And it was first applied to the second king of, it was applied to Nabonius, who was the son of Nebuchadnezzar. And it's a term that's often applied to the monarchy. And you have rising stars and falling stars. And Lucifer is normally the falling star, the eastern star. And Jesus is called Lucifer in Book of Revelations. So if anyone wants to condemn Lucifer, well, they're condemning Jesus, because Jesus was also called Lucifer. Why was he called Lucifer? Because he was the eastern star as well. Mary Magdalene and Mary the Virgin were both the eastern star. The eastern star is Isis, Venus, Aphrodite, and they were all incarnations of Aphrodite, the eastern star, Lucifer. So they were all Lucifer. So you can't really say, you know, Lucifer is the devil. That's a total misunderstanding. Mm. And Queen Guinevere was Lucifer as well. She was Venus. That's where her name comes from. She, Gwenna in Welsh means Friday. And Friday is the day of Venus. Vendredi in French and Italian and Latin and whatever. The day of Venus. And so Guinevere was...
It's actually in any really way related to actual, like, what they consider the scary Satanism, you know, the child sacrifice and the so on and so forth.
No, I think that's just all scare stories for kids. Anything that they don't like or they don't agree with, they have to demonize. And the easiest way to demonize it is just to say, oh, that's the work of the devil, whatever, you know. It's an easy way of just demonizing anything.
Well, it's the same with rock music.
Ah, well, yeah, anything they don't like. But they had to do this because there were so many stories that conflicted with the story that they were trying to create. So Christianity was based on a story concocted by Saul, who was Josephus Flavius. From a Roman's perspective, for Roman ears, to try and quell any further revolts on the eastern borders of the Roman Empire. And so it had to be this story of a prince of peace, a pauper prince of peace, rather than a warrior monarch who started a war on the eastern borders of the empire. The Romans didn't want that story. And it actually says in Jewish war, and this is where we start linking in with Arthurian history, because Arthurian history says exactly the same thing, that Josephus Flavius was commissioned to write this book. So the first one was Jewish War, but then he wrote the Gospels as well, and take it to the barbarians beyond the Euphrates to stop any further revolutions. Because this book said the Romans were almighty and you can't start a war with Rome because Rome will always win, etc., etc. And who were the barbarians beyond the Euphrates? Well, they were the princes of Edessa, because Edessa is just across the Euphrates. And they were known as barbarians because they had beards, rather like yourself. You're a barbarian. That's well, where we get the word. Yeah, that's where we get the word barber from. Because they had beards, and that was one of the particular traits of the Edessan monarchy, is that they wore beards. And just think of the image of Jesus for a bit. They wore beards, and their ceremonial crown was a crown of thorns. That was the ceremonial crown of Edessa, was a crown of thorns. And Josephus Flavius specifically says that the leaders of the Jewish revolt, after the revolt had failed, there were three leaders of the Jewish revolt who included King Jesus Manu of Edessa. And they were crucified in the Kidron Valley outside Jerusalem. But Josephus Flavius himself came along while this was going along. And he came along and he saw them being crucified, and he petitioned the governor of Judea and Jerusalem to take them down from the cross. So he had them taken down from the cross. They were given medical attention. Two of them died and one of them survived. Familiar story? Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the gospel story of the crucifixion. And the person who took them down from the cross was called Josephus of Arimathea, Josephus Flavius. So we have another manifestation of Josephus Flavius. And they couldn't call him Josephus Flavius in the gospel story because, A, that would mean the dates were all wrong, because Josephus Flavius was not born until AD 37 after the crucifixion was supposed to have happened. And they don't want him associated with Jesus and the crucifixion and being the savior of Jesus, because he was the traitor. He was a Jewish traitor working for the Romans. That's the last thing they want, to be mixed up with the story of Jesus. So they had to create another name, and so they called him Josephus of Arimathea instead. But yeah, this was Josephus Flavius. This was part of the original historical story, and it's in the history books as we know them. And the person he took down from the cross was called Jesus Manu of Edessa. He was the king of Edessa. And he was the guy who started the Jewish revolt.
Now, so getting into the Arthurian stuff now, then, isn't it?
Yes, it did, because Arthurian legend picks up on this continually all the way through. And this, I wrote a short chapter on this in the book King Jesus, and then I had to come back and revisit it because it was blaring at me that there were connections here. Because Arthurian history says very much the same thing. So if you read something like Merlin Grail, which was written by Robert de Boron, this is 13th century, he says that the traitor who sold Jesus to the Romans was Josephus of Arimathea. And you've got to think, hold on, that's a little bit heretical, you know, because if you read the gospel story, he's the great hero of the gospels. He saved Jesus, as it were. You know, he took him down from the cross. And in later tradition was supposed to have taken him to England and all that sort of business. He was the great hero of Christianity. And yet in Arthurian legend, he was the traitor, not Judas. He was working for the Romans. He had worked for the Romans for 7 years, apparently. No, 5 years. And he was the one who sold Jesus to the Romans. So you've got this heretical story, which is not the same as the gospel story. And so I had to have a look at it. And it turned out to be a very, very interesting story indeed. This was my last book, which was The Grail Cipher. And there is a strange thing with Arthurian history in that King Arthur does not exist. So we have the very early books of Arthurian history because, you know, King Arthur was supposed to be a 6th century king, you know, Dark Ages king of England. And yet the historians from that era don't mention him. We have Gildas, who was 6th century himself. We have the Venerable Bede, Nennius, then Will Malmesbury, who wrote about him. We're moving on now to the early 12th century. Malmesbury wrote about him, and Henry Huntingdon also wrote a history of England. And none of them mention the full King Arthur story at all. You know, things like Gildas doesn't mention him whatsoever. Bede just mentions there was a warrior called Arthur. Nennius does the same. There was just a warrior called Arthur. There is no King Arthur whatsoever until we get to Geoffrey of Monmouth and Walter of Oxford at the beginning of the 12th century. So we have a 600-year gap where King Arthur is missing, totally missing, from the historical record. And you've got to ask yourself why. If this was, as a later chronicler, William of Newburgh, says in his history, he was, again, mid-12th century. He wrote a book after Monmouth and Oxford, a very good, very readable history of England. And he says of the Arthurian history written by Monmouth that it's a tissue of lies. It is impossible, if King Arthur was such a famous and powerful king, for his history to have been kept a secret for 600 years before Malmesbury wrote about it. So even after Malmesbury, people are ridiculing this history as being a total fabrication. So why did Malmesbury and Oxford write about it? Suddenly, in 1130-ish, Malmesbury and Oxford are the only people to suddenly write about a king called King Arthur. Why at that stage? Why? Because the Knights Templar had just come back from the Crusades. So the first Crusade was in 1096, I think it was. And here's another strange thing as well. It was, It's so long since I've done this, I'm forgetting all the characters.
And it's really early in the morning, so we'll forgive you.
And it's really early in the morning, yes. So, yeah, the first crusade went out, was organized by Count Baldwin of Boulogne. And he went out to Judea, obviously, to try and liberate Judea from Muslim control, because it had been taken over by the Muslims. But the first city they went to was not in Judea. It was Edessa. So the first city to be liberated from Muslim control during the First Crusade was the city of Edessa, the city of King Jesus Manu, the very person we've just been talking about, who was the biblical Jesus. And you've got to ask yourself, why on earth did they... Because it's nowhere near Jerusalem, of course. You have to go beyond the Euphrates to get to Edessa. So why did the crusaders, in their crusade to Jerusalem, go in totally the wrong direction and go to Edessa instead? Why? Because they understood from their old history that Jesus, King Jesus, came from Edessa. And if you were going to find any secrets, and that's part of what this crusade was about, if you're going to find any historical secrets about the gospel era, you're not going to find them in Judea, you're going to find them in Edessa. And that is where they went to. And of course, Edessa was still a Christian city at that time. It might have been controlled by the Muslims, but it was still a Christian city, as were all of the cities in this region. And so when they got to Edessa, they were welcomed in as conquering heroes, and the Muslim garrison just faded away into the night. And that would have been in 1098. Now, any returning crusaders and Knights Templar, because the Knights Templar were only founded in 1119, I think it was, and they weren't ratified as an organization until 1129. Now, in 1135, Malmesbury starts writing his Arthurian history. So, literally just 6 years after the Knights Templar were established, Malmesbury and Oxford start writing Arthurian history.
So the Knights got back with a relic that he managed to translate.
Yeah. They came back with some information. They came back with what I think was another gospel. And this gospel is mentioned in the works of Josephus. And this gospel, it would be a real history, was the history of the kings of Judea, written by Justus of Tiberias, who was James, the brother of Jesus. So it's a history of Judea written not by Josephus, because we've only got a single view of this history written by Josephus, who was a Jewish traitor working for the Romans, of course. So it's a very partisan view.
A one-sided propaganda piece, basically.
Very much. Roman propaganda. What this other history was that the Templars brought back from Judea was an alternate perspective on what happened during that Jewish revolt era, the era that created the New Testament. And so it was written actually by the brother of Jesus. It was written by James. And they brought this history back, and it was a completely different history, because this was not the sugar-coated version. This was the real history. And it detailed Jesus as a real king of Syria and Judea, not as some sort of pauper prince of peace. But so they brought this history back, and they brought it back. And where did they bring it back to? Well, the count who had gone out there was Count Baldwin of Boulogne. And where does Arthurian history come from? It comes from Normandy, from Boulogne. It's not a British story at all. It doesn't come from Wales. All of the manuscripts come out of Normandy. Mm. Even the Malmesbury manuscript, which everyone says is Welsh, came from Normandy, because Malmesbury was a Norman commander's son living in Wales. But he was Norman. He wasn't Welsh. He was Norman. And most of these manuscripts were written in Latin or Norman French. They weren't written in Welsh. So this story came back at this era. But what can you do with this story? What could the Templars do with this highly heretical story? This was a story of Jesus that said he was a king, a real king, that he lived in the AD 60s, not the AD 30s, that he started a war with the Romans, that he lost that war, he was crucified, he was taken down from the cross, he survived physically, not spiritually, he survived, as Josephus Flavius tells us, and was taken prisoner by the Romans and taken to Rome. That is hugely heretical. How on earth can you tell that story in the early 12th century, in the medieval era? You cannot. Not even the Templars tell that story.
Unless you like the idea of being killed or tortured to death, you know, just...
Yeah, if that's your thing, you know, go for it.
If it takes your fancy, and you know what, I'm just going to tell the real story about Jesus. Excuse me, Mr. religious priest person. I've got something to say.
Mr. Pope, yeah.
You know,
yeah. So what are they going to do with it? So what they did very cleverly is they crafted this story and they grafted it onto the history of England instead. And they did it in quite a clever but also clumsy fashion because they mixed up their history a little bit. What they tried to do is find an English king who had a similar history that could be used, that they could graft this story on top of. And the king that they found was Constantine III, who, again, you probably wouldn't know about because he's been sort of semi-deleted from history. Constantine III was a king who came out of Normandy, out of Brittany, and became the king of England when the Romans had just left England. So the Romans left Britain in about 405 AD, and this king became the king of England in about 411, just after the Romans had left. And he gathered an army together and went and attacked Rome. And very temporarily, for a couple of years or so, he became the emperor of Rome. So he became a British emperor of Rome. So this guy had some similarities with what the Jesus character was doing in Judea. He started a war against the Romans. And so they could graft this history of Jesus upon the Jesus character, upon this British character called Constantine III. But we know it's that our theory in history is not based upon Constantine III because all the rest of his history is completely wrong and he's in the wrong era. But the details of the Jesus character fit perfectly with this new Arthurian character. And so they created this new history of this new fictitious king who lived in the Dark Ages, called Arthur, with his 12 knights of the Round Table. And we know this is all linked to the New Testament story because, well, for so many reasons. I ended up writing a 650-page book about this. For instance, the Knights of the Round Table were the disciples of Jesus. That's why you have a round table surrounded by either 12 disciples or 12 Knights of the Round Table. And just to make this very clear, Arthurian history says that the table of King Arthur was based upon the Last Supper table. So there were three tables that were made. There was the Last Supper table, which was a round table. It wasn't a rectangular one, surrounded by 12 disciple knights. Remember, all of the disciples were armed with swords. They were knights. They weren't just disciples. Then there was the table of Josephus of Arimathea, who, as we've said before, was Josephus Flavius. And he had a round table with 12 knights. And then the third one was the table of King Arthur, which was, again, a round Last Supper table surrounded by 12 knights.
Is there a zodiac thing going on there with, like, the 12 months and the round table and the circle and the sun in the middle?
Yes, Absolutely. So the Jesus character sits in the center of the table. He doesn't have a place on the outside. He sits in the center of the table because the table is a zodiac. And each of the disciples or each of the knights of the round table were a constellation of the zodiac. And they would have all been associated with a particular zodiac that had their particular character associated with them. And that's what it was all about. We're going back to the original religion of Egypt again, that the Nazarene were following the Egyptian religion, which was a processional astrology religion. And that's why we have the round Last Supper table. And we know this because if you go to Jordan and modern Israel, they've done archaeology in that region, and they've uncovered, I think there's now 8 ancient synagogues dating from the 1st century up through to the 6th century. And all of them have a zodiac on the floor, a large mosaic zodiac on the floor. So we know that the central component of early Judaism, and remember this is Nazarene Judaism, not Orthodox Judaism, the central component of Judaism was the zodiac. Because that's the central component on the floor of each synagogue.
What's the difference between the Kabbalah and the zodiac?
Well, the Kabbalah is a mystical form of Judaism, which I haven't gone into that much, but I don't think they venerate the zodiac as such.
Moving on.
Yeah, moving on. I've not seen the zodiac in the Kabbalah, although it is very esoteric and it has lots of meaning. But unfortunately, it's one of those books which it has so many loose ends, you could make up any meaning you like, I think, from it. But we know from early history that...
It sounds like reading a horoscope.
Yes, you can do exactly the same with the horoscope, yeah, very much so. But that wasn't the original purpose of astrology. The original purpose of astrology was processional astrology, which... the constellations change with the millennia, not with each month, but with each thousands of years. And they change every 2,000 years, roughly. And this was venerated and maintained because you could maintain a history of the royal family. So all you need to do is identify which constellation each monarch is identified with, and you know what era he came from. So if you have a king who is a shepherd king, you know he was born under Aries.
Kind of like how the Mayans use systems of tens and metric, and the Egyptians use systems of zodiac and multiples of 12.
Yes, very much zodiac so. Signs. So if you come across a king like Alexander the Great, who was identified with a ram, because he always wore the ram's horns in his hair, you know he was born under Aries. Same with Ptolemy III, the king pharaoh of Egypt. He was a Greek pharaoh. He was always identified with the horns of a ram, as was Moses. You know these people were born under Aries. But Jesus was identified with a fish. He was a fisher of men. And so he was born under Pisces. And so we know when he was born, and we know he was special because he was the first king of Pisces. And of course, the Pope still wears the fisher ring. He still wears the fisher mitre. If you look at his mitre, it's the fish mouth mitre. And Arthurian history has a whole line of fisher kings. Why? Because they were the kings of Pisces. So we're talking about processional astrology here. And if you go to the Sea of Galilee, there is one of the best zodiacs there, just south of Tiberias. And in fact, this is where I love history, because history and modern archaeology all come together, because Josephus Flavius mentions this zodiac. He says he was sent by the Judean authorities to a location 4 furlongs south of Tiberias to destroy the images of animals that they had drawn there. And if you go 4 furlongs south of the south gate of Tiberias today, you come to Hamat Tavira, which is where the zodiac is. And you've got this great zodiac on the Sea of Galilee. And this is the very one that Josephus Flavius was sent to destroy. But before he got there, the synagogue that it was in was destroyed and covered it up, and the person who did that was Jesus. It all starts to fit in. This is all part of the same story. And it's still there. You can go there now. It's a wonderful zodiac. And it's a processional zodiac. We know that because of the positioning of Helios. So you've got this zodiac, and in the center you've got Helios on his quadriga chariot, his chariot and four horses, wearing a crown of thorns, as they do. And this is the Jesus Helios character as the Son of God, S-U-N, Son of God. Which works in the Greek as well, by the way. It's not just an Anglicism. And interestingly enough, in this zodiac, and it's available online, you can see it, Hamat Tavera zodiac, the Helios character is holding a spherical blue-green earth in his hand, which is very telling, because A, it's a processional zodiac, so it's obvious that they understood procession of the equinox, and they got it completely correct as well, the right era, the right date. And it dates this zodiac as a first century, early first century zodiac. But here you have Helios, the sun, holding a spherical earth in his gravitational grasp, which was actually a common symbolism within Greek and Roman coinage. You can find it, especially in Greek coinage, you can find the symbolism quite a lot, where Helios is holding a sphere in his earth, in his gravitational grasp. But this earth is not just a spherical earth, it's a blue-green spherical earth. So they not only understood that the earth orbited the sun, the standard heliocentric system of the solar system, but they also understood that planet Earth was a sphere that looked blue and green when viewed from space.
And 2,000 years later, people for some reason still don't understand that.
They still.
I guess that's called a bit of Flavius disregard for history, then.
Yeah, a bit of regression back into the Dark Ages, yeah.
The Neo-Dark Ages. I love it.
Neo-Dark Ages. Well, it is in some respects, especially if you go to sort of mid-America. It's very Neo-Dark Ages down there. So this was the understanding. This was the technology. This was the science that was held by these Gnostics. So you can see the difference now between a vacuous religion like Christianity or Orthodox Judaism, which has no real understanding of why they are doing things or what their texts mean, and a Gnostic religion like the Church of Jesus and James, which did understand their texts and did understand the world around them, so much so that they knew that the earth was a blue-green sphere that orbited the sun. That was the technology and the understanding that they were trying to preserve and perpetuate within the Gnostic community. And people like Hero of Alexandria would have been a part of that, of course, you know, the great technologist of the first century. Mm. That's why Jesus used him to create his water-to-wine jugs and other various tricks.
Yeah. And he also created the Gnostic frying pan.
Yes. Yeah, that came a little bit later, but they would have done if they could have done. But they had things like the pinhole camera. You know, it's all been speculated that the Dutch masters used pinhole cameras to create their wonderful, very naturalistic paintings of people and scenes and so on. And it was speculated that Leonardo da Vinci had a pinhole camera to create his Turin Shroud and things like that. But Simon Magus, back in the first century, Simon Magus is the alternate Jesus from the first century. he's the one they called. He was just a magician because he created miracles just by magic, not by God. Although how you differentiate between the two, I really don't know. But anyway, he was an alternate Jesus, probably of the older generation before Jesus, who was condemned as a magician. He's the Merlin character from the Arthurian story.
Meaning he had an understanding of how to create technology that people didn't understand and think that it must be magic.
Precisely. And one of those things was the pinhole camera, because one of his tricks was to create a little boy out of nothing who would then, as you went up to him, would just disappear and went back into nothing. And if you think of a pinhole camera, a room-sized pinhole camera with you sitting in the, what do they call it? They call it a camera obscura. And we know this came from Rome because a camera obscura in Latin means a dark room. So you sit in the dark room, you've got a little boy outside, you've got a pinhole camera, and the image of the boy is projected onto the back wall of the room, and you've got this image, this ghostly image of a boy on the wall of your camera obscura, of your dark room. And you go up to the image, and the boy's not there. This was the technology they were using to show their technological superiority, I suppose, over other people, to amaze monarchs, to amaze the aristocracy, to amaze the people, and thereby maintain their own power over the people. It was technology-based.
Hmm. Now, we're coming very close to the end here, so if there's any particular loose ends you'd really like to wrap up for the audience, or a shameless self-promotion that you would like to thrust upon, go for your life.
Yeah.
Remember, of course, there's a caveat here. There is nothing shameful about shameless self-promotion, by very definition.
Yes, it's something I should do more. I do too much writing and not enough self-promotion sometimes, I think. So this is a very long piece of research that started 40 years ago. So I've been writing all of these books for a long, long time. The first book came out in 1997, I think it was, which was all about the pyramids, which is another thing I do as well. So there are 11 or 12 books in the series, and we start with the Old Testament. So we have things like Jesus, Last of the Pharaohs, Eden in Egypt, which is interesting because I identify who Adam and Eve were in that particular book. Tempest in Exodus, which tells us what the Exodus was, and as we mentioned before, I link it with the Hyksos. Skota, Egyptian Queen of the Scots, that's interesting. That's taking Irish and Scottish history, because the Irish and Scots say that their people came from Egypt, from refugees from Amarna, from Pharaoh Akhenaten, who ended up in Scotland. That's what they say in Scottish Chronicon and the Labor Kabbalah. So that's Skota, the Egyptian Queen of the Scots. Mm. And then we roll into the New Testament. We've got Cleopatra.
We are just running out of time here now, so I just want to give people the website. It's edfu, edfu-books.com. That's edfu-books.com is the website for Ralph Ellis and the 12 books of his in the series. Thanks very much for joining me today at the wee small hours of the morning. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for donating very generously at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. There is nothing shameful about shameless self-promotion. We'll see you again sometime. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Vinny. Bye-bye.